So, ERCOT governance. As I mentioned, the PUCT has jurisdiction over ERCOT under Chapter 39.151. And following Winter Storm Uri, it became very political that some of the ERCOT board members were not residents of Texas. And so, in response to Uri and some other criticisms of the ERCOT board, Senate Bill 2, during the most recent legislative session, made changes to the composition of the ERCOT board. It will be very interesting to see how these changes to the board play out and how market protocols are developed over time. Historically, we had a 16-member board. The majority of the board members were from the market segments. They represented the generation segment, the independent power segment. They represented the transmission distribution utilities. They represented the retail electric providers and large industrial consumers. Following URI, the legislature decided that we should have political appointees as our ERCOT board members, and we've had our first two ERCOT independent board members named. One is, the chair will be Paul Foster. He is an El Paso businessman. He's the president of Franklin Management and the founder of Western Refining. In addition, we have Dr. Carlos Aguilar, who was the CEO and board member of Texas Central Power's partner, the high-speed rail project in Texas. So we also have ex officio board members. The Public Utility Commission chair, Peter Lake, is a board member, a non-voting member, as is the ERCOT CEO. He's a non-voting member as well. And then the Office of Public Utility Counsel. The board members must be non-legislators, Texas residents now, have no fiduciary duty to any market segment, and they cannot have served in the next prior 2 years. So for those of you who have had the pleasure of going to ERCOT and working through the stakeholder process, this will be review for you. But ERCOT rules are known as protocols, and they are adopted by ERCOT and then approved by the Public Utility Commission. And these rules and regulations contain the scheduling, operating, planning, reliability, and settlement rules of the market. Courts have held that these rules have the full force and effect of statutes and regulations. And currently, under appeal following Winter Storm Uri, is whether the Public Utility Commission has the legal authority to order ERCOT to change its regulations. The commission did so in a pricing order during Winter Storm Uri, and I've cited that case, which is currently pending in the Third Court of Appeals now. That is the order that raised pricing during URI to $9,000 a megawatt hour during the EEA event that we had. The ERCOT members develop the rules in committees, and as I mentioned there, the members are comprised basically of every market stakeholder group in the market. So now we're going to get to the issue of why does ERCOT have limited import capacity? And as I mentioned, we have DC ties to the Southwest Power Pool and to SENACE. And if they're, you know, from time to time, clients have come to me and they have a wind project that they want to site in the Southwest Power Pool but have it deliver power into ERCOT. Or they have units that are capable of islanding and delivering power into ERCOT. Interconnections with ERCOT and the adjacent FERC-regulated grids have typically required a declaratory order, or the PUCT has required that business entities obtain a declaratory order from FERC affirming that the interconnecting utility for those generation units is not a public utility under Section 201 of the Federal Power Act, except as a result of some of the provisions of the Federal Power Act that relate to interconnection. And there's a long history of why that is the case. So currently today, FERC under the Federal Power Act has jurisdiction over interstate commerce, sales of wholesale power and transmission. But originally, in the 1900s, the electric grid was not heavily regulated. Cities regulated rates, and the utilities interconnected with each other primarily voluntarily. During the New Deal, as part of the New Deal, legislation was enacted to help curb some of the abuses of the public utility holding companies that had used their monopoly status as regulated utilities to fund their unregulated side of the business. And we saw the enactment of the Public Utility Holding Company Act in 1935. And then we also saw the enactment of the Federal Power Act, which established federal jurisdiction over utilities engaged in interstate commerce and also gave regulatory authority to the Federal Power Commission, which subsequently became FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Now, the Texas utilities saw what was happening on the federal level and did not want to become subject to FERC regulation. So they voluntarily coordinated intrastate into an organization called the Texas Interconnected System. And that interconnected system, for example, during World War II, helped deliver power to the Gulf Coast to provide excess power for the aluminum business and other industry that was needed during World War II. But the utilities effectively isolated their transmission systems from interstate commerce in the wake of the Federal Power Act. And it went like that for some time until another major event occurred, the 1965 blackouts. During 1965, the New York blackout spurred federal regulation that required electric utilities to coordinate better with each other. Blackouts have a way of inspiring legislators to act when it comes to the electric power system.